the idea that the West was more civilized is a sham, that in fact they are more barbaric. Even as a teenager, I knew that America was an empire. Colonialism occurred at the height of liberalism. It's an entire system that has been set up to extract and sort of as a parasite.
So the empire has lost control over the narrative. American Muslims are in the heart of this empire.
All of these sort of points of the legitimizing discourse are, as you said, being sacrificed one by one. The system was designed to do exactly what it is doing.
Does the American empire really need Israel?
If you don't have the power to make someone win, then at least make someone lose.
Yes.
When you're in the voting booth in November, ask yourself, how much does Palestinian blood matter to you?
Western hypocrisy over Gaza is nothing new. We all observe with horror how the same values they profess to hold are now repeatedly being flouted by politicians that lie with a smile. On both sides of the Atlantic, the charade that is Western liberalism is outed for what it is, an ideology created by Europeans to safeguard the interests of Europeans. The sacred cows of liberalism are one by one being slaughtered. But what comes in its place? How do we, as Muslims, lead a movement for true liberation against this malign idea? And more importantly, how do us Muslims in the heart of the empire put forward an alternative vision for the world? Today, my guest is Imam Tom Fakhini. Imam Tom is the research director of the Department of Islam and Society at the Yakin Institute and a prolific speaker and commentator on Islam and philosophy. Imam Tom Fakhini, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome back to The Thinking Muslim.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be together again.
Well, welcome to sunny Britain. The last time I met you, I think, was in Istanbul. I mean, yes. How's your stay been so far?
It's been lovely. It's been tremendous. The schedule is quite packed. A lot of people that I've met, a lot of institutions. It's been a bit of a whirlwind, but very, very enjoyable, mashallah.
I mean, what's your observations, your preliminary observations of Muslims here in Britain?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are very specific pockets in the United States that have the type of density where you feel like, you know, this is a very Islamic space or Muslim space. That sense is much more widespread in the UK and in London in particular.
Yeah.
So to be in neighborhoods where you can sort of close your eyes and feel like you're in a Muslim country, I know that's to the horror of the far right, you know, Londonistan, right, as they said, and these sorts of things. But for us, obviously, it's a tremendous thing to see the cultural gravity, right? And because if you go into the study of the Sharia takes into account sort of majoritarian versus minoritarian logic, not just within legislation, but also within culture, right? And so it's, I think, a modernist sort of misunderstanding to imagine that a Muslim polity or an Islamic polity would be only Muslims. No, that's not true at all. And that's why we have several sort of mechanisms within the Sharia to accommodate non-Muslim minorities.
Yeah.
But the goal of those, or the overarching objective of those sort of mechanisms, is to provide a pathway for other people to come into Islam and to be influenced by Islam. Right. So there's almost like microclimates, you know, in London and other places where that thing is possible, where Islam is not just it's not a religion in the modern secular term of what a religion is. It's actually a cultural force,
yeah,
a cultural force that is actually attractive, that actually has sort of influence and is a player among the many sort of cultural players. Mm-hmm. So that's tremendous.
Fantastic. No, jazakallah khair. Now, I said in my introduction that we're going to today talk about the sacred cows of liberalism, mm-hmm, and how, in a way, Gaza has slaughtered those ideals that you and I may have grown up believing are universalist ideals that everyone shares. But also in my introduction, I talked about the American empire, and it's quite a controversial term. I mean, how do you, as an American, see America? Do you observe it as an empire?
Even as a teenager, I knew that America was an empire.
Really?
Right. And this is something that is a well-established discourse on the progressive left and on the radical left.
Yeah.
You know, 9/11 was what politicized me, and it started my sort of journey intellectually of sort of trying to put the pieces together of history and theory and
this
philosophy.
Before you embraced Islam.
Oh, yeah. Well before I embraced Islam. And so, you know, reading Chomsky and reading you know, Howard Zinn and these sorts of classic sort of leftist authors, within that sort of lane, it's no secret and it's no sort of shyness around saying that the United States of America is an empire. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, why is it so hidden? And this is actually a perfect segue to what we came here to talk about today, because there's a great divide and disconnect between what is the legitimizing discourse of either a philosophy, an ideology, or even a nation state versus the reality of it.
Yeah.
Right. So if we look at the legitimizing discourse, if you go to all the history books that I read in the official history books, you know, published by McGraw and Pearson and these sorts of things, it's all the American pageant, the American mission, the American venture, you know, Plymouth Rock and, you know, the Mayflower and you know, all these sorts of a triumphalist narrative.
Yes.
Right. And perhaps we can admit that there were some Piccadillys along the way and some, you know, indiscretions and some things that were short, but we're always marching forth together, you know. It was a very ideological history, more of memory.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Very much so, right? And it masks several things, and some things are more well-known than others. So some of the things that it masks are the foundational sins or the original sins of the American project, which, of course, are the North Atlantic slave trade, and the enslavement of black people, and also the extinguishing and extermination of Native Americans, which were not simply instantaneous and infinitesimal sort of projects. You know, this is not limited to the 1600s or the 1700s. It wasn't something that happened in the past. It's ongoing till today, and that's what people don't realize. Okay. I gave a Thanksgiving speech at Hamilton College in New York a few years ago, and the point of the speech was that the land grab never ended. You know, the colonialism hasn't ended. In fact, there's just wave upon wave, and the logic and sort of the manifestation of it continues to shift, right? So, okay, particularly take Native Americans. They were, you know, slaughtered in certain instances and then pushed out, forcible removal in other instances, and then herded onto reservations in then other instances, and then forced to give up their lifestyle and their worldview, an epistemicide, you know, where they're forced now to individual plots of land as opposed to communal plots of land. They're forced into private property, Lockean private property, as opposed to other ways of ownership and use. Yeah. They're forced into the schools in Carlisle and in Pennsylvania and other schools where they kill the Indian and save the man sort of thing, right? The boarding schools that were famous in all over North America, right? But it's still going on today. Now, if they find oil underneath the ground of the reservation, now we're going to now expel them a second time. If they had some sort of native, sort of traditional right to a body of water, and now we want beachfront property, now the developers are licking their chops and rubbing their hands, and they're finding ways around to seize and appropriate their land. Yeah. It's the same exact thing. Who among them will sell out and collaborate with us that I can make a deal with, whether it's legitimate or illegitimate? We'll worry about the legality later. And the more I talk, the more you see the similarities between Gaza and Palestine and how these things continue to happen. So the United States is an empire, but it's not a traditional empire in the way that we understand traditional empires with formal land holdings as the UK had or as France had or the Dutch or any sort of other sort of, maybe we could say, classically liberal empire.
Yeah.
Because if we're going to talk about liberalism and the sacred cows of liberalism, just to for people to appreciate the disconnect between reality and ideology,
yes.
People don't associate colonialism with liberalism. Yeah. We talked about this before the last time I was on. Colonialism occurred at the height of liberalism. In fact, European colonialism and racism was the output, the direct descendant or product of liberalism, right? So these things are not, the way that we study history, it's almost like there's this fog of war, right? Oh, there's this, over here, there's racism, and over here, there's colonialism, and oh, here's, that's the good part. These are all together. Nice. In fact, it's produced by the other. So there is an American empire. It's not traditional in the way of land holdings, but if you look at the map of military bases across the world, if you look at the financial colonialism that the United States has wrecked on the world, which is why BRICS is a significant thing, which is why China announcing that it's going to introduce a currency trade that doesn't have anything to do with the dollar is a significant thing, which is why certain nations that have attempted to move away from using the dollar or the sort of petrodollar scheme have been punished politically and economically, which is why certain nations, if there is even a populist uprising and a new regime that takes place, the first thing that happens is that the United States freezes their assets. Yeah. Their gold is somewhere in a bank in Nebraska under lock and key, and then the United States can shut off the spigot at any point at once. The UN and the IMF and the World Bank and all these sorts of international organizations, especially post-World War II,
yes.
we see that these are actually the levers and mechanisms of the American empire, right? Some people say, and with all due respect to people, I appreciate that everybody is trying to find creative solutions, but invoke Article 6 of the UN and the Habibi, what good is the UN? Mm-hmm. The UN is doing exactly what it was designed to do, right? Everything that we have right now is doing exactly what it was designed to do.
Yeah.
Whether it's IMF, predatory loans, they come to Egypt. What do they say to Egypt? They say, oh, Sisi or Maxisi or whatever the joke in Egyptian social media is. If you open up the border and let the Zionists push the people of Gaza into Egypt, we'll forgive your IMF loans. So now you want me to tell you this is just some sort of natural, you know, order, rule of law, these sorts of things.
Yes.
There's the legitimizing discourse. Yes, rule of law and order and international system and checks and balances and this and that and the third. Freedom, democracy, progress, technology. And then there's the reality of a thing. The reality thing of that these things create dependencies. They create vulnerabilities. They create power. There are levers of power, and those levers are being pulled mostly by the United States.
Yeah.
So in terms of formal landholdings, no, the United States is not a traditional empire in the way that we're used to thinking about it. But in terms of these levers and mechanisms of power that it pulls and pushes to punish, to remove, to intervene, I always find it rich when the United States is upset about Russia interfering in its elections. You know how many elections the United States has interfered in across the last 100 years? You know, it's the pot calling the kettle black, or as we say, people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, right? So this is the American empire.
Yes.
Now, what makes it so sinister and hegemonic is that if in earlier traditional forms of empire, such as the British, you have a clear enemy, and the French, and et cetera. So if the Algerians want to revolt, they know they're revolting against the French,
yeah,
and the Algerians that collaborated with them. Okay. All of these mechanisms of power operate in the background. They operate not entirely in secret, but there's a front of respectability and pomp and circumstance and fairness.
Yes.
So they make it very, very difficult to pinpoint that this is going on, both from the people who suffer abroad and for the American people who bankroll it. Right, we look at our tax bill. Everything's going up. Life is deteriorating. Healthcare's in shambles. We're paying for Israelis to have free college education. Our education is a scam. It's a neoliberal sort of racket. People are suffering in the United States. The quality of life has plummeted.
Yes,
people have very real addiction. There's opioids. There's all these crises that keep on unfolding one after another. Wave after wave.
Yes.
But because there's no clear identifiable enemy to put your finger on, it's perpetuatable. It perpetuates very easily, or much more easily, right, than to say that, okay, it's like, well, there's this one politician, right? Or there's this one party, or it's an entire system that has been set up to extract and sort of as a parasite, leech as much as it possibly can get away with from the American people,
yes,
and then to apply it to mess with and intervene and control and subjugate and rob and kill and maim other actors abroad for the material interests of a very, very tight circle of elites, both political and economic.
I mean, that's really interesting. And the way you describe the parasitical nature of the American empire, I think it chimes with what we're seeing at the moment in Gaza and the what has come out of the Gaza situation. Now, there is an intense discussion in the literature in America about whether it's declining or not. And I would like your take on this. But I've spoken to speakers, I've interviewed guests, and they all point to the fact that Gaza, in a way, symbolizes American decline at a very deeper level. I mean, do you see that? And, you know, what's your broader thinking about American decline?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think that the decline has been in progress for quite some time. You could say that the United States was at its height of power in the 50s. Yeah. I think that would be a fair play, 40s and 50s, the post-World War II era, in the immediate aftermath. And culturally, I think that you could say that power continued to crescendo. Not necessarily, you can make an argument for militarily or economic, like yes, like certain things were increasing, but how things unfolded with Korea in the 50s, and Vietnam in the 60s, and then some of the things going on in the 70s, fires keep on popping up.
Yeah.
Right? There's warning signs. that not everything is okay.
Yeah.
You know, the infiltration of drugs, the sexual liberation movement, the AIDS pandemic, like all these sorts of things that should occurred or started to unfold wave after wave are sort of almost like warning bells, like something's not quite right here.
Yeah.
And as we continue into the 90s with the war on drugs, quote unquote, then we have, you know, the recession, obviously 9/11, the recession, and things that continue to unfold, you know, the housing bubble and all these sorts of things. It's been wave upon wave of sort of deterioration. Now, that's just talking about sort of hard economics and quality of life and things like that and culture. But there's other fronts as well that demonstrate that the grip that the post-World War II order exerts upon the world is starting to slip. Right. And that's where I think what you said is spot on, that especially Gaza and especially Palestine.
Yes.
Just look at how far the Overton window has shifted, right? So if we're going back to the support of the Israeli occupation, the types of conversations we're having now are unprecedented.
Yeah.
When it comes to questioning the right of an Israeli state to exist, period, right? That was not on the table.
Yes.
10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago,
yeah,
right? Support for Israel was considered, as the president, Genocide Joe, has said, ironclad.
Yes.
Okay, he's on increasingly on an island on that statement.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go back again 10, 20, 30 years ago, you would find that was a very predominant sentiment. Mm. Like, oh my goodness, like these people who are, you know, white and look like us, quote unquote, and they're, you know, seemingly modern and civilized are under attack by these turbaned men shouting Allahu Akbar and these sorts of things. And then obviously we've talked many times about the ideological sort of components that Zionists and unfortunately some of the sellouts in the Muslim world contribute to and fund that sort of ideological component of it. But people are waking up across generations and specifically Gen Z when it comes to, you know, connecting the dots. We've had the democratization of information with social media so that legacy media is now, there's I'm on the split as a millennial. I am the first generation to get my news mostly from social media as opposed to legacy media, New York Times and CNN and Fox News or these sorts of conglomerates that are profit dominated and corporate driven,
yes.
Right? Anybody my age and younger, the split is very clear when it comes to the types of information that you're accessing, the types of voices that you're accessing, yes. Which is why the ADL has panicked, which is why the IDF has panicked, which is why you've got people, you know, Zionists on the phone. They call in Elon Musk to do some sort of birthright trip or some sort of ideological re-education camp for Elon Musk to make sure that he toes the line. You've got Zuckerberg, you know, who's, you know, now introducing new things with Instagram and Facebook that, oh, political content, mashallah. I mean, political content, you're not going to see it unless you opt in. These sorts of games that they're playing, right? It's in response to what has happened with the democratization of media and information that now if everybody's a journalist, and now if we have a global audience, now those really simplistic textbooks that you read in history class are not where you're getting your sense of history from.
So the empire has lost control over the narrative.
The narrative, exactly. The empire has lost control over the narrative.
Really?
Now, there's some imperfections to this or some complications, right? Like the culture war is complicated because unfortunately, and this is, I would send a message to American Duat and Western Duat.
Yes.
That this global order is more important than the culture wars. I think that some people, they see everything through is the culture wars.
Explain the culture wars to us.
So the culture wars, we could say there's a couple fronts or let's say flashpoints that illustrate a longer tension between sort of a conservatism versus sort of a progressivism.
Yes.
And so people, especially you take Black Lives Matters in, you know, the 2010s and the sort of neo-Marxist politics of, you know, looking for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And this is sort of a pole or a camp within the culture war. It's like progressive politics, you know, very leftist, very identity politics, right? We are Muslims as a minority. We are searching for sort of to secure our rights through this. Our allies are the African-American community or other oppressed minorities. And we're going to march through this sort of coalition to secure our rights after a long sort of period of grievance. This is a poll. The other poll is the more conservative poll, which, and both sides have truth in them, but unfortunately, it's been a site of polarization and therefore simplification and fails to be able to account to what's going on globally. And that's, people talk about American exceptionalism. I say half the things that people talk about American exceptionalism, I agree with. And the other half, I think they're off. This is a true example of American exceptionalism. When if you're ramming everything, so I'll complete the picture. So the people on the other side, in the conservative side, you know, are much more likely to be the Jordan Peterson types or the red pill types or the we're interested in cultivating sort of, you know, relationships with the right, you know, which again, isn't necessarily a problem, but I'm showing the constellation and associations. People on the other side of the culture would never, ever care about, you know, what's your opinion on Andrew Tate? That will tell me which camp you're in, you know, these sorts of things. So within that national culture war context, and there are elements of this culture war also in Europe, you know, we don't want to get into that necessarily, but it doesn't, it's not the only thing going on, right? It's not a truly global universal frame with which to understand what's going on in Gaza. Or so how this actually hinders us is that people see what's going on with pro-Palestinian activism. Okay, now it's true that many of the pro-Palestinian activists in the United States, they come to it from a more leftist perspective.
Yes.
However, it's also true that those activists have more of an appetite for Islamic activism and for Islamic sort of politics than has ever been, perhaps, since 9/11, certainly, right? And so the culture war side on the right that's more conservative will say, oh, these people are just, you know, Nepo babies and, you know, all these sort of dismissive, denigrating things to dismiss, you know, that it's all grievance culture, this is all sort of agitation, it's all... where's the submission to Allah and the ridha, the pleasure with what Allah has decreed? This is like not like the way, it's not the tradition, et cetera, et cetera. And the other side is guilty of the same sort of characterization of the other. You all are white supremacists. You all are, this is all, you know, we have white converts occupying Islam. I've heard that been said, right? This is also simplistic and not helpful in my opinion. So the liability of this or the obstacle that this poses is that it prevents us from really transcending the issue. It forces us to pick a side as opposed to transcending. Gaza offers us an opportunity to transcend that binary and to march forward with something that is truly Islamic. That's neither a right-winged Islam or a left-wing Islam. That's not a sort of secularized version that's domesticated within the frame of identity politics. Nor some sort of neo-trad version that's like very, you know, Abrahamic sort of thing, right? I don't agree with either of these camps, though both of these camps have some truth to them, right? What we really want is to transcend those that binary and dichotomy, which at this point is just sort of each side reacting against the other and constantly trying to score points against the other, to move forward to something that's much more indigenously Islamic, holistically Islamic, and honestly productive.
Can I
please
point that out? So just make a point about that. I mean, I've argued very similar positions here in the UK, but I suppose pre-Gaza, the thing that dominated the debate in the Muslim communities here in the UK and across Europe, but also in America, was the rise of maybe LGBT engagement in schools and the apprehension that caused amongst Muslim parents. There were demonstrations in Detroit, I think, in Minnesota. So, of course... You know, there is going to be, because the progressive left are trying to change the perceptions within the Muslim community, the ideals within the Muslim community, there is going to be a pushback to that. Are you saying that we should transcend those? I know you're not saying that, but we should transcend those issues and maybe ignore them for the great for the greater sort of international issues?
No, that's not what I'm saying. And thank you for bringing that up so I can clarify. What I'm saying is we need to move from a position of reacting against the other side, that we're taking this position because it's anti-progressive or it's against the progressives, to moving to a place of true principle where we will actually be in a situation where we'll say, well, on this issue, actually the truth is with the progressives. And on this issue, actually the truth is with the Republicans or the conservatives.
Right.
We're not there right now. Right now it's ping pong. Right now we're oscillating, you know, violently between each side, culturally dominant in the BLM and the aftermath of BLM, the left was culturally dominant. And so Muslims were throwing themselves in with the left with all of the problems and excesses that caused. Then what we had was the LGBTQ, imposition very aggressively on schools. And then the pendulum started swinging back in the other direction in some ways that were very important and helpful and necessary, and in other ways that were excessive and just reactive. right? So the Gaza gives us the opportunity to extricate ourselves from that violent oscillation and to come to a place of true principle that what we want is something that is actually foundationally Islamic, that is based on principle, that if we're with the left on Monday and against the left on Tuesday, that doesn't bother us because we're not now playing respectability politics or brown-nosing somebody or, what do you say here, buttering somebody, right? In order to ingratiate ourselves to this or that or the third, thinking that that's what politics are. Rather, it's about identifying and articulating and delineating what are our principles, where do we stand on this issue, that issue, that issue. What's the goal that we're trying to achieve? How do we reverse engineer to that goal, right? As opposed to basically relying on other than us to get things done and say, well, who do we have to befriend and kiss up to?
I'm interested in your analysis of how Gaza has become a symbol of American decline.
Yes.
We've heard over the last few months the most ridiculous justifications for why Israel should be supported. One such justification is the right of Israel to self-defense. And often, you know, we retort back to you know, American spokespersons who argue that, look, Israel was attacked on October the 7th. Our response to them is, well, what about international humanitarian law? What about human rights, right? What does Gaza tell us about, I suppose, a very Lockean principle that we are all equal in value and equal in worth? How does that demonstrate that?
Yes. Well, Locke was a slaveholder, and so he didn't believe that. Right. And he also was the architect of not only the North Atlantic slave trade, and not just simply someone who profited from it, but an architect of the racialization of the North Atlantic slave trade.
Yeah.
Early 1600s, you know, the North Atlantic slave trade was not simply based on racial lines. There were other people and ethnicities that were being enslaved. But Locke was instrumental when it comes to the racialization of that, so that now it's, you know, it got a lot more strictly racial as opposed to just sort of opportunistic and sloppy. Mm. So we can take that and throw that in the bin.
Yeah.
But I think what we're saying about all of these sort of points of the legitimizing discourse are, as you said, being sacrificed one by one, being slaughtered in broad daylight, right? As we see one after the other. The idea that Israel has a right to self-defense falls apart very quickly when you ask, do the Palestinians have a right to self-defense? In which case, they would never grant that. And then you have Iran being attacked, and then them responding an attack, and then they try to, the same Israel, which was blowing off the UN saying, we're going to do whatever we want no matter what you say, now wants to call a meeting at the UN to reprimand Iran for doing at least, you know, maybe 1/100th of what Israel has done.
Yeah.
Right? So this has become a very clear charade. And, you know, these things, when they used to be sort of long and drawn out and not as public and the public eye was distracted by other things, then maybe you could lose track of who had the ball. Yeah. Now it's happening in the matter of weeks, where one week something is being said, the next week it's being contradicted. And so the hypocrisy is on clear display for all to see.
Yes.
We see also this when it comes to the nature of the way in which warfare is being conducted, right? Israel has done absolutely everything under the sun with complete barbarity. So the entire idea of the post-World War II order, and people, you know, they go, well, they're not doing anything that was different from Dresden. Well, we constructed supposedly the post-World War II order to prevent another Dresden from happening, right? So the whole idea of all these institutions, the UN and the you know, its tentacles, and the IMF and its tentacles, and the World Bank and its tentacles, and all these forums were supposed to prevent the barbarity of what preceded in World War II and before. And we see that it has been completely incapable, that it has only prevented resistance from the people who are being oppressed, and that the rules only apply to those people who are really being subjugated and targeted, right? And so, again, another moment of clear hypocrisy where the you know, we've seen every type of weapon being used, every type of person being used, women, children, innocent men, you know, every single tactic. We see the AI and the use of surveillance, the ubiquitous use of surveillance, and social media in cahoots with surveillance, ratting out Palestinians, getting them assassinated. Even I think you all have a journalist here, or is she in the US? I can't remember. You know, basically putting out an assassination, call for individual Palestinians. Yeah. Right now, when the Ayatollah of Iran puts out a fatwa for Salman Rushdie, that was an international scandal. And mashallah, it was an indication that we in the West are civilized and we're beyond that. And now we see the exact same thing happening in 2024, where Zionist journalists and talking heads get on and they essentially call out individual Palestinian journalists, not even people who are really, you know, fighting, journalists, to get them assassinated. Where is your civilization? And there's something very macabre about all of even the traditional sort of soft power of the West, you know, with the Grammys and the Oscars and this award and the Nobel Peace Prize. People have stopped believing in the whole charade.
Right.
And you keep your Grammy and keep your awards gala ceremonies and this pomp and posh nonsense and people with their gowns on the red carpet and stuff. It's all been exposed as extremely hollow and just sinister and a mockery of what humanity is supposed to be. People have said this many times. The West has no right to lecture anyone on human rights and things like that. That's only the beginning, right? The entire artifice of cultural power, of superiority that has been projected for decades and decades, if not centuries, has fallen, right? The idea that the West was more civilized is a sham, that in fact they are more barbaric. And we have seen at the highest levels, who are the people who have humanity? If you take the normal, your normie Gen Zer on TikTok, ask them, who has more humanity? They'll say the Gazans have more humanity. The Palestinians have more humanity. They're more civilized. They're more advanced. Maybe they don't. Maybe they've had all the technology taken away from them. Maybe they've had all of their, they've been reduced to eating animal feed or worse, right? But who actually has humanity? Who are the people who are qualified to lecture the rest of the world on what it is to be a good human being? It's not any of this entire artifice. It is the people of Gaza and the people of Palestine. And that's not to say people have to understand people of Gaza are not perfect. The people of Palestine are not perfect. We're not romanticizing or fetishizing anybody. As we know, the Zionists love to recruit and conscript individuals who have a dependency or an addiction or something like that, and they use them as their talking head. Look, oh, we have a Palestinian saying this. Oh, we have a Gazan saying this, right? The native informants and things like that. We're not saying that these things are based off of identity politics. What we're saying, though, is that the barbarity that has unfolded has exposed the entire project of Western superiority upon which liberalism was founded, right? And we're talking now, okay, legitimizing discourse versus reality. Who's the self of Locke? Why don't we talk about the fact that Locke didn't have in his idea of freedom the African slave? Okay, because he believed in the superiority of the white European.
Yeah.
And so the entire theory and the entire order has been built upon the assumption of the superiority of the white European.
I mean, I asked you this question the last time you were on the show. How closely knitted, or how do we, can we separate white supremacy, I suppose, from liberalism?
I mean, it's very entangled and enmeshed, right? The freedom that was articulated by Locke was the freedom of the white slaveholder, right? If you want a book to go to, you should read Ugly Freedoms by Elizabeth Anker.
Yes.
That goes in on Locke very in fine detail. And so, and this is the same to the Constitution. You know, Locke helped chart or theorize and write the state constitution of the state of South Carolina.
Yes.
And those ideas were carried over into the Constitution of the United States, that the three-fifths compromise was not an accident, right? The freedom that's being talked about, the we the people, right? Who's the we? Who was supposed to be the people, right? It was actually a very, very small subset of people that were white, that were landowners, right? That were men. These things are well known. So there's been sort of an ideological sort of papering over, right? Just like the Christians have this innovative sort of idea. What do they call it? Progressive theology, right? So you ask an evangelical Christian, why didn't Moses preach the Trinity?
Yes.
They'll say, well, there's progressive theology. They weren't ready for that yet. It had to wait until Jesus came, and that's how they reconcile that.
Yes.
So we have a similar thing going on with liberalism, where there's almost like this progressive theology of liberalism, where Locke and all the big founders of liberalism were only theorizing for the white slaveholder. But as time goes on, we're going to paper over and say, oh, well, it actually includes women too. Yeah. And it actually includes, you know, black folks too. And it actually includes, you know, Muslims too, yeah. Right? And that papering over is busting at the seams now.
Yes. Are you saying, in effect, that the same Lockean notion of centering liberalism within this white supremacy paradigm exists today in the way they view Palestinians, the way they view deaths in Gaza.
Absolutely. Like, these things are not neutral, and there is no such thing as neutrality. Yeah. Even to take Locke's attempt to anchor the ownership of the self and the autonomy of the self and the moral autonomy of the self within the territory of the body is a very loaded decision to make. It's one that is a secular decision to make. It has sidelined the divine. It has sidelined the soul. Yeah. Now it becomes optional, right? Your calculus does not depend inherently upon the existence of a God or the existence of an afterlife or the existence of a soul. Mm-hmm. That's a very political decision to make, right? And so all of these things are very much enmeshed. I don't think that they can be separated. And I think that, again, as we said, the system was designed to do exactly what it is doing, mm-hmm. right? This is now liberalism and the West will try to save face and say that, well, this is just incomplete liberalism. What we need is moral liberalism. Once we figure it out, we'll keep going and we'll, you know, it's not being applied correctly. Everything's good in theory, but it's not being applied correctly. Yes. I think the ship has sailed on that. I think that we see that the entire thing has collapsed and that it was wrongheaded, and these are actual consequences of the theorization that extend directly from it.
Can I ask you about the media landscape in the United States? I mean, we always associate the U.S. with absolute freedom, the idea that you can say what you want and no one's going to censor you. Unlike many European countries, there is a right to freedom of expression, and you can't really pursue someone who does express themselves in the United States. The constitutional rights are very much embedded within society. Mm-hmm. But yet, over Gaza, we have seen really strong media manipulation and the censoring of pro-Palestinian voices. How does one reconcile those two things?
Well, that's a wonderful question. Now, it is true that structurally, there is more freedom of speech in the United States than in Europe. We have that entrenched with more teeth. So nobody can, strictly speaking, in a vacuum, necessarily, it's not illegal to be an anti-Semite or to be some neo-Nazi or something like that. Like, those groups exist. Yeah. And the KKK still exists, right? Now, what has happened is that there is a front in the ideological battle that, you know, some people call lawfare, right? Yeah. Where you're attempting either to bleed people financially through tying them up in sort of, you know, court cases and litigation, or you're trying to construct an artifice that now has legal standing that will be able to turn the screws on your opponents, mm-hmm. right? So this is why we live in the shadow. And I was meeting with some people yesterday talking about the necessity of us completely demolishing the discursive formation of extremism and terrorism. Right. Not to say that we're against, that we somehow support political violence. No, we don't. We don't support political violence. But let's call it political violence. Why did people start calling it terrorism?
Yeah.
People came up with the term terrorism to delineate a specific category of Muslim violence, right? In order to punish it in a specifically harsh way, because if it was treated under other types of laws, then it would be less dramatic. If you look at the anti-terrorism legislation, the consequences for this thing, if you're a convicted terrorist, you're a pariah. You know, the sentences are enormous compared to other sorts of things, right? Which is why when people look and say, oh, if this militia in Oregon took over a federal building, which they did with guns, right? And it occupied it for weeks and they get a slap on the wrist. That's because the artifice of the construction of terrorism was not applied to them because it was never meant to be applied to them.
Yes.
Right. So now you'll have other people that, so one tactic is to say, well, okay, now we need to apply it evenly. We'll apply terrorism to the white supremacists as well. Okay, maybe. But in reality, I think it would be much more important to just demolish the whole thing entirely. Like, terrorism was always an ideological move. Extremism was always an ideological move to punish Muslims.
Right.
In the post 9/11 era. It was nothing else, right? And so, again, it's designed to do exactly what it's doing. It's designed so that people like you and me have to think twice about what we say. That you can have someone like Norman Finkelstein who can say on Piers Morgan that not only is some actions that were performed understandable, but that even the hatred that they experience is understandable. Mm-hmm. He can get away with that.
Yeah.
You or I could say that and we're done for, right? Now, again, is it a strict matter of legality? Yes and no. If we go constitutionally, No, you're safe by that, technically. But now we've constructed this artifice. The Zionists and their friends among sort of the Muslim collaborators have attempted to construct the artifice of terrorism and anti-terrorism legislation. They've done that. They're constructing the artifice of extremism and anti-extremist legislation, and the agencies that follow after them, such as PREVENT and such as CVE and these sorts of things, the Patriot Act. And now the new front is trying to construct the artifice of hate speech and anti-Semitism. So this is the thing that's going on now in the United States. The House of Representatives just passed support for, now it doesn't have any teeth for engagement, but its support for the phrase "from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free" is anti-Semitic. Okay, so this is how it works. So the game is to try to create this artifice, which is hate speech. Anti-Semitism is the worst type, or the emblematic type of hate speech. Hate speech is punishable. Now we're going to make this phrase that you're saying hate speech. Therefore, now we can prosecute you. And even if we can't get like strict jail time, we're going to make so that your university gets rid of you, so that the NHS gets rid of you, so that the you're not going to be employable, right? The doxing sort of strategy.
Yeah.
So this is all lawfare. This is all sort of what's happening. So there's all these avenues in which Zionists are trying to basically work around the safeguards of the Constitution. I think yesterday, if not this week, that the president of Columbia University hauled in front of a congressional hearing, and she's not the first. Many other presidents have been hauled in front of, and she throws her professors under the bus. She doesn't say, oh, academic freedom, they can say this, oh, they didn't to say that, like Joseph Massad and the other people at Columbia, doesn't defend them whatsoever. She knows the game. She knows that just like the other two were pressured into resigning, or the alumni funding is going to be retracted or something, they're going to be denied some sort of federal grant or something like this. This is the method that they're going through. Is it necessarily, did she, violate a constitutional right? Technically, are her constitutional rights protected? Yes. Technically, are the author's constitutional rights protected? Yes. But there's other levers to push and there's other strings to pull, that basically you have an entire class of people that are ideologically committed to building these levers and strings so that they can push and pull on them when they want to, to silence, to punish, to, silence people.
Can I ask you about Israel and its usefulness to the empire? I mean, does the American empire really need Israel? I mean, from a political, cultural, ideological perspective, is it really required for America?
So yes and no. And that's because there's many different ideas about what America is. And this is actually a fight that's going on right now. What should America be? Right. What is the identity of America? What is the American project?
Yes.
Right. There are some people in the United States of America that think that the American project and ideal is something that is entirely contained to its borders, that it is about a radical type of freedom, a radical type of sort of rugged individualism, frontier life, and all this sort of stuff. Mm. And so this is sort of the America First wing of the idea of what America.
Trump,
he plays both sides. Oh. Like, so he plays into the, he'll say anything, first of all. You'll find him saying things, contradictory things in the same meal, let alone the same week. But you've got, on the right, you've got the America First. America First is not, some sort of ideal movement. They've got some of its xenophobia, some of its white supremacy, some of its other stuff. But other people, it's just political.
Yeah.
You've got neocons on the right, which is much more expansionist sort of thing. On the left, you have globalists, right, which is the occupying sort of thing of Democratic Party. Yeah. People who believe that what is America must be exported. It must be the world order, that we have the responsibility, world's policeman, this sort of thing. We're leader of the free world.
This is a dominant strand in the Biden administration.
Yes, this is Biden completely. And all the establishment Democratic Party,
right.
Clinton's, as a family, Obama. And Obama, and the whole nine. You have to go back, quite far to find Democrats that aren't sort of this persuasion.
Yes.
And so, this is a tussle over what America should be and what it means.
Yeah.
Those who are... the incumbents are the globalists and the neocons, the ones who do support the American empire, like as an empire, Project for a New American Century, and all this sort of thing, right? There's growing influence in the isolationism or the America First movement, or even on the left, sort of progressive politics that are against sort of intervention in this sort of way.
Yeah.
So those things are picking up steam. I apologize, I forgot your exact question.
So the question was really about whether America needs Israel.
Yes, good. So depends on what you think America is, right? If you believe in the neocon or globalist idea of what America is, then yes, America needs Israel, absolutely. That it is the last colonial outpost in the Middle East. It is the biggest sort of military base. It is extremely lucrative for the experimental technologies of AI and the military industrial complex. Yeah. It is the cutting edge, right? And it's no accident that they named one of their operations Operation Cutting Edge. Mm-hmm. It is the cutting edge of sort of American empire in the Middle East. Look at how all of the other nations, the policy of the United States is sort of, you know, meddling in other nations, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and elsewhere, is all predicated upon its relationship with Israel, right? This is like a fundamental piece that's the queen on the chessboard when it comes to this idea of what America is.
Yeah.
But there are other ideas of what America is that don't involve Israel at all. And that's actually, you know, the Candace Owens of the world,
yeah,
the Tucker Carlson's of the world, with all their warts. We're not, you know, praising anybody as, you know, this is the new savior of the ummah, right? With their warts, with their shortcomings and their, you know, conspiracies or whatever their faults are. But there is an increasing noise, an increasing din of people who are saying, wait a second, this doesn't make any sense.
I mean, how significant is that on the Firster, the American Firster, right? Because there is a cultural justification for Israel amongst those people, right?
Right. Well, it's the most significant it's ever been. Mm. Let's put it that way, really? Right? Like, yeah. So you would not. It's again, like, there are some things that are, the Overton window is shifting. There are certain things that are happening today that were unimaginable 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Right.
10, 15, 20 years ago, it's unimaginable that a former Fox News anchor in Tucker Carlson would break with the right in such a public way.
Yeah.
Go interview Putin, question the United States' involvement with Israel, right? And to have then be joined by someone as high profile as Candace Owens, that's not a possibility 10, 15 years ago, right? Now, it's not just a possibility, it happened. So there's going to be, like, this is like the Tea Party on steroids. Like, this is something that within the age of social media, again, the new generation, it's going to have ramifications. I'm really interested to see in how the up and coming generation of conservatives is going to look like. How much purchase, I mean, I'm not in those circles to know, but how much purchase does the neocon sort of vision of the world have with a 20-year-old conservative? I don't know. I don't really have a whole lot of reason to believe that it would have or make a ton of sense. Right? When, especially as I said, especially as the lived experience of Americans is, I think, observably getting worse and worse, right? Like, you know, real estate prices are ballooning, skyrocketing everywhere, rents and mortgages and things like that, interest rates, availability of jobs, wages can't keep up with inflation. Inflation was horrible. Like, for America, which usually doesn't have problems with inflation, inflation was like something like 10% the previous year, right? These are, you know, people are really feeling it, right? So, that questions people to take a pause and reevaluate things and say, wow, why are we sending so much money to this nation? Why are we, if people are upset with sort of the welfare state, because the right, they're very upset and take exception to of the potential of a welfare state, you know, in the United States, you know, welfare queens and people mooching off the system. Supposedly, that's what they all, you know, complain about.
Yeah.
Israel's a welfare state. Israel is way more of a problem than a welfare state domestically. It's a welfare state abroad where you're funding settlers, you're funding their weapons, you're funding their education, you're funding their civil society. They're living the leftist dream in the Middle East on the kibbutz or wherever, and you're funding it and you're hurting. At a certain point, you're only going to be able to tell that person, well, there are these dangerous Arab guys there. You're only going to be able to tell them that for so long before they start to put the math together and say, wait a second, this can't keep going.
I want to ask you about the campaign, Abandon Biden campaign, which I know you're quite intimately involved in. I suppose I've got two questions about it. I mean, what do you hope to achieve from it? But also, how do you respond to the charge that calling Muslims to participate in a crumbling system is no more than upholding the values of that crumbling system?
Good. So I'll start with the second part first.
Yeah.
I haven't seen an argument or any particular evidence to demonstrate that participating in something upholds it.
Right.
That is not, that's not a logical necessity, right? You can participate in something precisely to ruin it. Yeah. In fact, This is something that Trump did with the CVE. Very few people realize that Trump effectively ended CVE.
Right.
Not CVE being the countering violent extremism. It's the U.S. component of sort of prevent. It's the U.S. equivalent of prevent.
Yeah.
Now, he didn't do it out of his own good graces or his own brilliant competence or morality. He did it through his dysfunction and incompetence.
Really?
So he, when he came into office, he changed the name to Countering Violent Islamism. And the director resigned, and then a bunch of other people resigned. And before you knew it, the whole thing unraveled. So with unfortunately, with insufficient pressure from the Muslims, he's completely sabotaged it. Okay, it's very easy to participate in something and ruin it. And it might be strategic to do so sometimes.
Yes.
You know, it comes down to intentionality. What is your intention? And your strategy. Like, what are you actually trying to achieve? And are you matching your tactic to the strategy that you're sort of unfolding? So I don't believe for a second that, simple participation in something means you're upholding something. No. And the counterexample I give is, if that were true, let's put the shoe on the other foot. If every single American stayed home for the next election, what would be the result? Does the system crumble? No, everybody goes back to work and the system carries on, right? In fact, if you were to argue anything, I think there's a stronger case to say that if you, for a person who's like an accelerationist or something like that, I'm not saying that's me, but like, let's say that you want the system to crumble. You have a higher chance of making it crumble by participating in it than you do from staying home, right? They love that you stay home. They'll say, it's like, oh yeah, we had the votes. Here's the majority. They won't mention how many people voted or the majority or the minority of people who voted. They'll say, look, this is a clear mandate and here we go. Right? So I don't buy that argument. The strategy of Abandon Biden, and there's many people involved in Abandon Biden campaign, and not everybody has the same understanding or goals of what it is, but I'll tell you my particular personal take on it. I think that, and I think it's so crucial that Muslims think sequentially. We fail a lot to think sequentially. That there are, just like if you build a pyramid, you have to have the first level has to be quite wide.
Yes.
And then the second level less wide and et cetera until you get to the top. We want to put the roof on before we build the foundation, right? And that's, it's naivety and it's inexperience. And we are naive and inexperienced generally as a Muslim community when it comes to politics, right? So it's not, the question is not, can we elect the next president? Can we decide who is the president? Can we run someone? Oh, but Trump is this. Oh, but this person is that. It's all irrelevant right now because we don't have that power right now. What Abandon Biden is about that first step about building power. Now, some people say, well, Abandon Biden is useless unless you endorse a candidate. I completely disagree. Yeah. I think the opposite is true. I think that if Abandon Biden endorses a candidate, that's where we find trouble. Because the Muslims in America will not unite around one candidate. There are some Muslims before October 7th were going to vote for Trump. There are some Muslims that before October 7th were going to vote for a third party. There were many Muslims that are going to stay home. There are Muslims that were going to vote for Biden. There are Muslims of every political persuasion. What can we actually unite around? We can't unite around a candidate at this point.
Yes.
What we can unite around is that Biden is guilty of genocide. He has killed 40,000 of us and that it is legitimate as a political strategy to make him lose in the next election.
Yeah.
That is something you can unite, not all the Muslims, but all of the Muslims that are conscientious. And actually, that's an essential service to provide because we need a clear delineation between the Muslims who are prioritizing their Islam over their other sort of, you know, whether it's careerism, whether it's their opportunities, their appointments, whatever they hope to gain through the Biden administration. Yeah. We need that clear separation. We don't want muddy waters, right? Up until now, we've had very, very murky waters. And in fact, there's a big chess match going on, when it comes to how to manage and steer the anti-Biden sentiment in the United States. So just by the Qadr of Allah, one of the first states to have its primary election was Michigan.
Yeah.
Now, Michigan had a feature on its ballot, the uncommitted feature. So it became very obvious and apparent to everybody that the easiest method of doing a protest vote was to vote uncommitted on the Michigan ballot. Okay, that was beyond reproach. However, there were some organizations that jumped on the uncommitted movement, and their intention is, at the end of the day, to drive Muslims back to Biden. Because uncommitted, the messaging of uncommitted is ambiguous. There are some people who vote uncommitted with their intention being never Biden ever. No Joe whatsoever.
Yeah.
There are other people who vote uncommitted. They're saying it's like, well, I want the Democratic Party to change. I want them to choose a different candidate other than Joe Biden. But if they don't, at the end of the day, I'm going to vote for Biden against a Trump presidency. Okay. So the positive thing was that it showed a protest vote. It was successful in, according to some metrics. The downside was that it muddied the waters. Now we've got people in one sort of, people of two different camps that are behind one sort of movement. So the Abandon Biden campaign is essential to splitting that again. And this is actually what's going on in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has a primary this next week when the Abandon Biden campaign decided, because Pennsylvania is different. Every state in the United States is very different, unfortunately. Well, there's good reasons for that as well. But with elections, it makes it somewhat difficult to coordinate a national strategy. So Pennsylvania does not have an uncommitted option on the ballot.
Right.
They only have the candidates that have warranted being on the ballot and then write-ins. So those who support going back to Biden in some sort of eventuality have said, let's write in uncommitted. So Abandon Biden has says, nope, we're going to write in, no Joe. We're going to split it and try to expose those people who are sort of just hanging on to our coattails, that are prepared to drive the Muslims back to politics as usual and ingratiate themselves to the Democratic Party, who at this point is an abusive spouse to the Muslims, yeah. Right? And there are some people, even people that I respect quite a bit, who have told me that the problem with Abandon Biden is that there's no leverage, that you get leverage by saying that you're uncommitted and then et cetera, et cetera. I completely disagree. I think that's this is completely backwards. Yes. Let me give you an example. Let's go with the abusive spouse. Your abusive spouse comes home, right? You're used to getting whoopings and beatings and this sort of thing. If you say, you know, I'm starting to have doubts about our relationship, how much leverage have you created for yourself? Mm-hmm. You might get some lip service. Oh, honey, I'm so sorry. I was totally wrong. I'm going to change. I'm going to turn over a leaf, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? That's different from you packed your bags, you changed the locks, and you said, like, I'm done, right? Hit the road, Jack, and don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more, right? Mm-hmm. Completely different situation. Now they're really panicked. Now they might actually change. It might be too late, or they might actually change.
Yes.
So I would ask all the American voters, which situation creates more leverage? A weak, meek, apologetic, oh, I'm uncommitted, I'm not sure. No, we are quite committed. We are committed to abandoning Genocide Joe and every genocide politician, genocide Democrat, genocide Republican. But we especially need to make the Democratic Party feel it. And I've had conversations with many of the young brothers in the UK about this district and that district. I know you've been doing tremendous work on this front as well, that if you don't have the power to make someone win, then at least make someone lose.
Yes.
You will change the calculus of both. Some people were like, well, we don't want to hand it to the Tories. If you make Labor lose and you make enough noise and say, look, we made Labor lose, our only goal this election is to make Labor lose.
Yeah.
No Labor, Labor lose, Labor in the bin. Whatever you want to say is your messaging, the Tories are going to take notice. If you pull it off, they'll say, oh, well, look at these Muslims, we're getting together. These Muslims are starting to actually have some power. We have to take this into account with our next calculus, which is where the fear-mongering and Mehdi Hassan, unfortunately, naively, went off on this week. And I want everybody to realize that this is completely false. His fear-mongering for the Democratic Party and driving people back to Joe Biden is completely misguided.
What did he say? Yeah.
He basically played up what Trump will do in the first 100 days of office. Worst case scenario, nuclear scenario. Oh, it's going to be this bad and this bad. Mehdi, Lahidik, this is completely, first of all, you don't know the reality on the ground, first of all. He got involved in something he shouldn't have gotten involved in, right? Before being prepped and educated about what the exact dynamics are. And then second, you are providing a pathway with your unfortunate influence for people to run back to your abuser, to the person who people showed photos to his face of dying children, starving children. He waved them away and said, I've already seen all these. And you want us to vote for that man. Where is your loyalty to the people of Gaza? So you want to tell me about, it would have been worse under Trump. And Mubin Vade has a very nice Substack in which he goes through some of the scenarios. Not necessarily. If Trump had been at the helm, right, this sort of political forecasting is very messy business and very approximate business.
Yeah.
That there are multiple scenarios. According to one scenario, it could have been worse. But according to other scenarios, we've seen the Zionists overplay their hand and it actually blow up in their face several times. There could be a scenario in which if Trump had been president, they would have overplayed their hand even more. It would have blown back even more, and then it would have stopped sooner. It's possible. We don't know. But that's not the real relevant question. The real relevant question every American voter has to ask, and I tell this to the crowds that I get, when you're in the voting booth in November, ask yourself, how much does Palestinian blood matter to you? How much does Muslim blood matter to you? That is the only question that's relevant on November, whatever it is, the first week in November when you vote.
And the argument that it's haram to vote, I mean, do you still get that discussion in America?
We do, especially when it comes to within the masjids, right? Like, so you've got Muslim organization that's outside of the masjids, sort of the nonprofit sphere and the advocacy sort of, you know, circles and things like that. Then you've got the mosque sort of circles. And it is still a very, very prevalent sort of attitude. Now, voting is a tool, right? And the tool can be used for various purposes and with various intentions. Voting in and of itself is not a bay'ah. It's not a declaration of your loyalty.
Yes.
It's not a declaration of your aqidah. It's not a declaration of which system of law you think is superior. It's not. Voting is simply a tool. It's a political technology, right? Political technologies, there's tons of them. And they can be used to various ends, in various ways, towards various objectives, right? So it's the particularity of the situations. And I'm not one of those people, and unfortunately we suffer from both extremes. I'm not one of those people who's going to go up on the minbar and bash people across the head and say voting is wajib, voting is wajib. I don't believe it is. I think, but I am a trying to, you know, things fall apart, the center cannot hold. I'm trying to hold the center together here, as that you can have an opinion, maybe personally, you think that on a case-by-case scenario, you don't want to be held responsible for military money going abroad. I would say first, then you shouldn't pay taxes, but okay, let's say you're compelled to pay taxes, and so maybe you want to refrain from voting at the national level. Habibi, what about your school board? What about your local school? What about your city council? Your city council is not sending guns and bombs abroad, okay? There's no argument that I've seen categorically so that voting up and down, the whole thing, is not is impermissible. I haven't seen an argument convincing me of that. I do think that there are situations, particular situations, where voting might not be permissible. And I can respect, you know, like people who take those sorts of, like, you know, accountability measures into consideration. But I don't see people saying that. When I see people saying voting is haram, it's usually categorical. It's usually entirely say this is the shirki system, the kufri system, this is the system of the kuffar. And these are not grounds upon which to, you know, the kuffar eat Cheerios for breakfast. Does that make Cheerios a kafir cereal and you can't eat Cheerios now for breakfast, right? This is a tool. And so within limits, with conditions, on a case-by-case basis, you can use a tool.
One final question for you. You guys, American Muslims, are in the heart of this empire. So you have probably a disproportionate responsibility to call it out for what it is and to work against it even. Often, and again, I've got a very imperfect appreciation of American Muslims, but we sometimes get the impression that many, many American Muslims have been sedated by American exceptionalism. I mean, are American Muslims up for this fight?
I think that if they're going to be up for it, this is the chance. Because again, things are as good as they've ever been in the sense of motivation, connectivity, just to see the amount of people who have started political action committees, which is our method or mechanism for funding politicians and political campaigns.
Yes,
probably a dozen or more of political action committees have been started in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
I know CARE has rolled them out. I believe there's some other organizations that have rolled them out. We're still infantile, unfortunately. We're inexperienced. We're making horrible mistakes. We're sort of fumbling around this and that and the third. However, the will is there. The will is there to do something different. People are paying attention. People are now realizing, wow, we've been behind. And I try to tell people to temper their expectations. We can't make up for 20 plus years of poor political planning in 6 months. It's not possible, which is why I think the Abandon Biden campaign is important, because Abandon Biden campaign is about not election 2024, though obviously somewhat about 2024, but it's more about 2028. It's more about 2032. It's more about 2036, right? It's that if you deliver a blow, a body blow, to this multi-million dollar entity, which is the DNC, and you take out their president and you agitate and you make him a pariah, look at how much he's getting interrupted everywhere he goes.
Yeah.
He's afraid. He's afraid to engage in a mass audience. He can't. He has to have these private meetings. They release the location just like, you know, minutes before he comes and these sorts of things. He's hiding. He's hiding from the American people, right? So if this is the power that we can exert, that we will have laid the groundwork for 2028. We won't have to go through these paces again. We will actually be at top gear instead of trying to, you know, grind through the low gears first.
Yeah.
You know, that all of this connectivity and the fundraising mechanisms and the voter education and even the networking that's going on and everything that has to be in place in order to actually have political influence, we're scrambling now to build it, okay? And the Abandon Biden campaign unites everybody behind a very clear goal, an actually achievable goal. And even if we can't achieve it, it's probably going to happen anyway, and then we can take credit for it goal. In order to position us in a better place for every election that's going to come, and in order to send a message to every politician that comes after that now the United States, now the Muslims of the United States have organized, and now you have to consider and make your political calculus with us in mind, right? So I think that there is more, I would say, more than American exceptionalism. Because here's one thing where I don't think the American exceptionalism sort of moniker fits. I actually think it's quite empowering in this particular instance. We are exceptional in our responsibility, in our duty. We have the most accountability in front of the Muslim Ummah right now, more than anybody in Egypt, I believe, personally, more than anybody in Jordan, more than anybody in Gaza or in the West Bank. The Muslims of the United States of America have the most responsibility and will be held to account the strictest and severest in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala than any other Muslim in the world. Because our tax dollars are going, our politicians are allowing it to happen, everything is happening because of the United States political system. And so let's lean into the exceptionalism if it's going to light a fire under people. Let's lean into the urgency if it's going to shake people awake. I think the biggest obstacle, rather than the exceptionalism, is hayat ad-dunya, right? Is what the Prophet ﷺ told us. When he talked about al-wahn, and he talked about Muslims being weak, despite being numerous, despite even being successful, right? Is that hub ad-dunya, wa karahiyat al-maut. We're afraid of being doxxed, which is why Gen Z is so awesome. They're not, right? We're afraid of losing our jobs, right? Look at the Google protest that just happened yesterday. 9 people got fired. They don't care. That's what we need, right? Some of the places I go and I speak to, I said, everyone in this room has to be ready to be arrested. Everybody in this room has to, because if you look at the 60s, look at the movements for civil rights, that's what they had to do. They had to be ready to be arrested, to have dogs sicked on them, to be beaten up by cops, to have fire hoses. And we hail it now, we shall overcome, and we sing these songs, and it's this mythic thing. It wasn't like that back then. They were being called terrorists then. If we want a similarly spectacular political victory, we need to be prepared to pay the similar political price. And until we're ready for that sacrifice, that's the danger, not being ready for that sacrifice, that we can't be too comfortable. And unfortunately, we suffer with this in America, with being too comfortable. The standard of living is too high. Like people, unfortunately, and that's not every American Muslim community, but it's many American Muslim communities. So we have to be ready to sacrifice, ready to take pay cuts, ready to move, relocate, ready to lose our jobs, ready to be doxxed, ready to get uncomfortable, ready to, if you're someone of means and of wealth, you should be ready to be called an anti-Semite and take them to court and go to litigation just so it can go to the Supreme Court. And now you've made a ruling that affects everybody. Someone comes after somebody who doesn't have means, what are they going to do? They're going to be cowed into silence. So this is the sacrifice mentality is the biggest thing I think that Muslims need to gird themselves with in order to pull it off. That yes, exceptional. We're exceptionally responsible, and we can be exceptionally successful, and we can help the people in Gaza. But we have to be ready to sacrifice.
Imam Tom Fakin, it's really been a pleasure speaking to you today.
Alhamdulillah, the pleasure's all mine. Thank you so much. Amin.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels, and head over to our website thinkingmuslim.com to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.